Our next matter, for the record, excuse me, is A220118. Alejandro Cruz Guzman, as guardian and next friend of his minor children et al., are appellants. State of Minnesota et al., respondents. Higher Ground Academy et al., interveners, also as respondents. And counsel for respondents, have you agreed upon a division of time?
7.5 minutes.
Okay. Very good. Thank you. And we do ask counsel, when you approach the podium, to identify yourself and who you represent before you proceed. And so, counsel for appellant, you may identify yourself and proceed.
May it please the court, Mr. Presiding Justice, I am Dan Shulman. I represent the plaintiff's appellants. With me also is Richard Landon from the Lathrop Law Firm. I'm from Shulman and Buskey.
Good morning. You may proceed.
May it please the court. We are here because the district court and the parties need an answer, want you to answer a certified question, which will basically operate as a guide to us as we proceed with the rest of this case. The question is, paraphrased, the issue that it raises is, does a violation of the Education Clause require a showing of de jure segregation? The court's actual question is the Education Clause of the Minnesota Constitution violated by a racially imbalanced school system, regardless of the presence of de jure segregation or proof of a causal link between the racial imbalance and the actions of the state? It is our position, and we think you should answer.
Early on, how do we define segregation? I see that there was no agreement, or at least, and the judge seemed to struggle with the interplay between segregation and racial disparity, connoting a difference, and then de facto and de jure prefaces segregation. How do we define segregation?
We define segregation as, the judge used the term racial imbalance. What that means is a population in certain schools that is that is much greater than what is the population of that student body in the entire school system. So in other words, if the school system has 20% African Americans, students of color, and there are schools that have a population that is beyond a certain percentage, and in this case, we are using percentages.
Because that's what the Department of Education has, these percentages, I understand
right. That.
But I was asking a broader question from a legal standpoint. Would you agree that that definition differs from the definition from Brown versus Board of Education, which references governmental sponsored?
No, I would not, okay. Because the Supreme Court in its decisions refers to both de facto and de jure segregation. So there are, segregation can be either one. And the segregation we're talking about.
So is the key predicate those phrases? So what's de facto in your?
De facto segregation is segregation that allegedly results in action, in imbalance that is not attributable to the state. Now, we have two justices, Douglas and Powell, from different ends of the spectrum, have both said that the distinction is not meaningful because of the history of this country. For example, housing segregation or isolation, which is the result of centuries of action by federal, local, and state authorities to confine minorities to certain areas. So segregation can mean either one. Sometimes.
So as parents sending their children to a charter school that's comprised 90% students of color, de facto segregation that's lawful, whereas de jure, where they're required to, would be de jure and unlawful?
Well, generally the second part of that is right. The first part probably would be regarded as de facto as opposed to de jure. If it was an issue solely of parent choice. So let me, if I can continue, and have I answered your question? I'm not supposed to ask you, so I won't do that. But I'm sure you'll let me know if I haven't.
Mr. Shulman, let me ask, is it your position, or is it your theory or your preference that these issues about racial imbalance, segregation, whether it's de jure or de facto, that those are necessarily part of your claim based on the Education Clause? In other words, do you want to have imposed on you requirements to prove certain facts related to racial imbalance, or would you rather avoid that proof and just simply focus on a more ultimate question, such as perhaps like the adequacy of the education received without regard for all of the conditions or causes, things that contributed to it? Do you understand my question?
I think I do. I think the undisputed facts in the record, and these are undisputed, the demographic facts sufficiently establish the racial isolation that would qualify as segregation and the racial separation.
Well, that's not my question, actually. My question is, I'm wondering whether you and your clients must prove anything about racial imbalance in order to establish your claim. I mean, if you could establish that the education provided to students is inadequate, and let's say that you established that, but you didn't prove the reasons why. Have you proved your claim under the Education Clause?
Certainly.
Okay, then, so why do you want to prove certain facts about racial imbalance and intent and causation?
I don't want to prove intent and causation. But these facts, I think, the undisputed facts in terms of isolation, racial imbalance in numerous schools in Minneapolis and St. Paul, I think standing alone should establish an inadequate education. Now,
Mr. Shulman, in answer to Judge Johnson's question, wouldn't that necessarily require a trial, which hasn't yet occurred, to present that evidence? So if
that's why we move for summary judgment, because we don't believe that a trial is required given the undisputed facts in the record concerning the racial composition and the socioeconomic status condition of these schools.
But is the record, to answer Judge Johnson's question, if you don't want to have to prove that, is the record, there's no factual dispute but that education in these school districts and charter schools, since they're interveners, is inadequate?
Well, that is what the Supreme Court said in footnote 6 in the appeal of this case. It is self-evident, that a segregated system of public schools is not general, uniform, thorough, or efficient.
And you're reading that, am I correct? You're reading that footnote 6 to say it is self-evident that a system of public schools that's segregated, regardless of whether it's de jure or de facto, does not satisfy the requirements of the Education Clause.
That's right.
Okay, but what if the Supreme Court meant it is self-evident that a system of public schools that's segregated because of de jure segregation does not satisfy those requirements? What if the Supreme Court's statement is limited to that meaning, then what happens to your theory and your motion?
Well, then we have to go back and prove de jure segregation, but that's why we're here. We need guidance. The court needs guidance. We need guidance as to what the Supreme Court meant by that footnote.
And I'm wondering if that's, I mean, that's crucial to your theory, it seems, correct? In other words, if you had an answer to that question, is that enough guidance?
Well, that's enough guidance for us to proceed, yes. I mean, that's the court's question. And the court puts it in terms of intent and causation, but what the court is saying, what the court is asking is, do we have to prove de jure segregation? Is that what footnote 6 meant? And it is our view that that's not what it meant for numerous reasons, which I will go into. Number one, well,
part first. Of why, though, I asked you earlier that the only case cite in that dissent is Brown versus Board of Education in that footnote. So well, would we look to Brown to answer the question?
No, that's not because there is another citation that follows that statement. And that citation is to Article 13 of the Minnesota Constitution. The next sentence where Brown comes in, and I can tell you, let me just give that to you. Regardless of whether, after the court said it is self-evident that a segregated system of public schools is not general, uniform, thorough, or efficient. Then it cites Article 13, Section 1. The next sentence, regardless of whether the context is a traditional segregation claim or a different type of claim, courts are well equipped to decide whether a school system is segregated and have made such determinations since Brown. Now, the court itself, in the court's opinion, says that, and I'll find it, here it is, says that the only cited federal cases in the whole decision were Marbury versus Madison. This is at page 16 and 17 of the court's opinion. The only federal cases cited were Marbury and Madison and Brown v. Board of Education, and both were cited purely for the purpose of illustrating justiciability. So I don't think the court, from that, the district court concluded that because of that, it would not be justifiable to, and this is at 17 of the court's decision, it would not be justifiable to read an intent requirement into the education clause. That's what the court said. The education clause guarantees a citizen's set of rights to this state's citizens that are not contained in the federal constitution or any federal law. Those rights should not rise or fall on the federal jurisprudence that develops around a wholly different right contained in a wholly different constitution. Consequently, this court will not impose an intent requirement at this juncture on this basis without further guidance from the appellate court. Then, of course, we agree 100% with that. But in the very next sentence, the court reverses its position and says, however, as discussed below, this court has concluded that intentional segregation, i.e., de jure segregation, must be established before an education clause violation can be found, because to do otherwise on this record would create an equal protection violation violate the supremacy clause.
You perhaps read my mind, which can be a dangerous feat. That was going to be my question. You apparently do not see a distinction. I was going to ask you a distinction between the concept that one must show intent, which everybody agrees one need not to violate the education clause, versus an intent to segregate, which results in a violation of, and that's how I read that those two sentences, well, not to be contrary with each other, but that if the issue is, and we answered it such that you need to show de jure segregation, then you would have to show an intent to segregate in a de jure manner, and then that automatically becomes, per the footnote, an inadequate education. Do you see that distinction?
The way I read it, I understand what you're saying. The way I read it is the court is saying that it declines, without further guidance from this court or the Supreme Court, it declines to interpret, to rule out de jure segregation, because the court sees that the only remedy would be the movement of students based on race, and that is forbidden by under federal jurisprudence and would violate the Supremacy Clause if that came about. Now, our view is that the court was wrong both on the law and the facts. The court, in its decision, cites parents involved and for the proposition that de jure segregation is required. The court is citing to the plurality opinion. When the court was split 4-4, there was a concurring opinion by Justice Kennedy. That, under well-established U.S. Supreme Court law, and I believe under any law, when a court is split evenly and there is a concurring opinion in one of the positions, the concurring opinion is the controlling opinion. Kennedy said, in the administration of public, of the state and local authorities, it is permissible to consider the racial makeup of schools and to adopt general policies to encourage a diverse student body, one aspect of which is racial composition. Now that, what Kennedy says, is consistent with prior Supreme Court case law, and I'm referring now to Swan versus Charlotte-Mecklenburg School District, and that is an opinion by Chief Justice Berger. And Chief Justice Berger said in that, school authorities are traditionally charged with broad power to formulate and implement educational policy and might well conclude, for example, that in order to prepare students to live in a pluralistic society, each school should have a prescribed ratio of Negro to white students reflecting the proportion for the district as a whole. To do this as an educational policy is within the broad discretionary powers of school authorities. Absent a constitutional violation, however, that would not be within the authority of a federal court. So,
Mr. Schuman, your time has expired, but if you want to conclude, you may do so.
I ask Judge Schlitter, could I ask a couple of questions before that? Is it your intention to prove it? You've made reference in your brief to the actions of the State Department of Education during the 1990s, including some of the public officials involved in the department. Is it your intention to prove are you going to ask the district court to find or conclude that those actions constitute de jure segregation?
Assuming that depends on how you answer the question, but if we are required to prove de jure segregation, absolutely.
Related question, looking at the Supreme Court's prior opinion in this case, Cruz Guzman, in part one, and I want to, I think, highlight the fact that part one of that opinion concerned your Education Clause claim, part two concerns your Equal Protection claim, but in part one, the court writes, in essence, appellants ask the judiciary to answer a yes or no question, whether the legislature has violated its constitutional duty to provide a general and uniform system of public schools that is thorough and efficient and ensures a regular method throughout the state whereby all may be enabled to acquire an education and dot, 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 and so on. And then later in the last paragraph of that section or the penultimate paragraph, the question is whether the legislature has satisfied its constitutional obligation under the Education Clause. So that part one of the opinion seems quite focused on the legislature. I'm wondering why the district court would be either obligated to or need to conduct a factual inquiry into actions by the executive branch for purposes of an Education Clause claim. I understand, it may be relevant to your equal protection claim, but for purposes of the Education Clause claim, given the text of that constitutional provision, given the discussion in part one of the Cruz Guzman opinion, why is the conduct of State Department of Education officials in the 1990s relevant to your Education Clause claim?
Because under the law, the implementation of legislative policy is committed to the legislature, is committed to the Department of Education. The Department of Education is charged with the implementation of what the legislature, of the statutes enacted by the legislature regarding education. If I can add one point, or
yes,
I'm done. Yep.
The court was wrong on the law and the facts. The undisputed facts in this record are that we have reached an agreement resulting in legislation with the State Department of Education in which no student will be assigned any placement on the basis of race, none, and in which parent choice will prevail to the extent it does now, subject to capacity restraints. So the court is wrong in its conclusion. In fact, it is speculation that that is the only way for the legislature to remedy the issue of segregation.
Very well, thank you, Mr. Shulman. 5 minutes of rebuttal. And so whichever counsel is proceeding first, the respondents, you may proceed. Please identify yourself.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you, Your Honor. Kevin Finnerty, Assistant Attorney General on behalf of the state defendants.
Thank you.
I wish to make 4 points. First, the Supreme Court's earlier opinion in this case does not mandate ruling for appellants. Second, the Supreme Court has repeatedly held the duty of the legislature is to establish a general and uniform system of education, and it has held that it has done so in Skeen, State X. Rel. Klimek, Jackson versus Board of Minneapolis, and it at least appears to have been applied in Board of Sauk Center, so that's somewhere between 110 and 150 years of Supreme Court precedence. Third, appellants have not done either of the steps needed to prove their education clause claim based off this court's decision in Forsland, which is one, prove they have not been provided an opportunity to get an adequate education, and two, prove that certain demographics cause them to not have that opportunity. Indeed, there's no evidence about either of those elements. Finally, as a reminder, I would tell the court that we're here on we're not here on an appeal of a motion to dismiss appellant's claim. We're here on a motion for them to win the case before discovery's been completed, before there's been a single expert report, and before there's been a trial of the merits. I'll start with the Supreme Court's opinion in this case. That was issued after this court dismissed the appellant's complaint. Appellant's complaint on the basis of justiciability. This court reasoned that it would be, to interpret the education clause would require a definition of what it means to get an adequate education and then evaluate whether the state was doing so. The Supreme Court reversed and said, excuse me, on page 12, of course, some level of qualitative assessment is necessary to determine whether the state is meeting its obligation to provide an adequate education, end quote. It then went on to say it would not shy away from its duty just because education is a complex area of the law. Appellants did not focus on this language, did not provide a qualitative assessment, and do not appear to focus on education being a complex area. Instead, they focused, as Mr. Shulman said, on footnote 6. But footnote 6, as Justice Johnson pointed out, occurs at the beginning of the equal protection due process section of the Supreme Court's analysis, not in its education clause analysis, and the district court was correct in holding that that does not mandate ruling for appellants. With respect to the general and uniform provision, the state pointed out the obvious, that the education clause does not mention anything about student demographics and would direct the court to the quote in Klimek that appellants provided in the reply brief, quote, the Constitution does not provide any provision that school districts shall provide free transportation to school children. This court could echo the Supreme Court and say the Constitution does not provide any provision that the state mandate demographic makeup of school children. In Klimek, the Supreme Court held that the general uniform provision was not violated, even though some school districts offered free transportation to school children and others didn't. It said the state rightfully set up the system and how it's implemented at the district level can differ. Likewise here, at the implementation level, certain school districts might have a different demographics than others in the state, but that does not violate the general uniform provision of the Constitution. To succeed with their education clause claim, the appellants must do what this court said in Forsland, prove they've not been provided an opportunity for an adequate education and prove that certain demographics precluded them from having this opportunity. Appellant's failure to tackle either of these requirements mean the court should affirm the district court's ruling. Appellants failed to provide sufficient evidence to win their claim of matter of law, and there are genuine issues of material fact that preclude them from being awarded summary judgment at this time.
Mr. Finnerty, I'm going to make maybe like a comment, and ask me if you can comment on my comment, if that makes sense. But, I mean, it seems to me that since the Education Clause was, I mean, I believe that's part of the original Constitution, 1858, but since then, the conditions throughout the state, whether they be economic, social, or otherwise, have varied. Society has progressed, evolved, and so on. But it seems like the Constitution imposes on the legislature the obligation to provide a certain system of education, regardless of the underlying conditions of the state of Minnesota. And that sometimes, you know, those certain conditions could, I mean, poverty, for example, can get in the way of effective education. And it seems possible that, well, there's been a case, Forsland, concerned whether the teacher tenure statute interfered with that goal. But would you agree it's also possible that the racial composition of certain communities within the state could be a condition that could make it more difficult for the legislature to achieve their duty, and perhaps even cause the legislature to not fulfill its duty? Is that possible?
I think it's possible, Your Honor. And as I said, we're not here to, you know, move to dismiss Appellant's complaint. We're suggesting that they should go forward and prove that element. They should prove that they are not being provided an adequate education, which the state disputes, and prove that whether it is poverty or racial composition is the cause of that. And they've not proven either one at this point, which would be required to win the Education Clause claim.
So could you succinctly state sort of what are the elements of proof of an Education Clause claim? Is it capable of a concise statement?
Yeah, I would go back to Forsland, which said you first have to show that you do not have an opportunity to acquire an adequate education. And then Forsland uses the term, and some variable causes that. And based off of this case, they've identified student demographics as that variable.
And why is the second requirement necessarily part of the law? In other words, you know, could not a plaintiff simply say the education provided here is inadequate? I don't know why, but it is, and so the legislature has failed in its duty.
I think it would be an interesting examination if there was an individual plaintiff who came forward to that. I presume there would be discovery and the state would explore.
Or a class.
But that's the difference here. This is a class action. I don't know that it would have been certified if there wasn't a common element about the reason why they were being deprived of an adequate education. I mean, you just gather up 10,000 people randomly throughout the state and say we're not getting an adequate education, but there's nothing common about it. So I think it's the fact that they have identified a common problem that's the second part of the Forsland that we look at.
I asked Mr. Shulman some questions about the distinction, I guess, which type of state action is relevant. I guess, the text of the constitutional provision and the Supreme Court's discussion in Part 1 of Cruz-Guzman seem focused on the legislature, but there's arguments and evidence and discussion in the district court about state action by the State Department of Education. To what extent is that evidence relevant here?
Well, I think, Your Honor, my time's up, so I'll answer your question.
Feel free to answer.
Yes. There's two components. As it was discussed with Mr. Shulman, the plaintiffs' appellants could prevail if they prove de jure, and that could, I think, incorporate some of the executive functions if they thought that was the part. They also have an equal protection claim. But on the what I would call the pure education clause claim, then you're focused on did the legislature establish it, which I said more than 100 years of Supreme Court precedent, and then are they getting an adequate education? So I'm not sure what plaintiffs are going to argue because there's nothing in the evidence about why they're not getting an adequate education, but I suppose if they thought something of the executive branch did it, it's more likely to focus on what's occurring at the district court level. But I think you're right, Your Honor, that part is more focused on the legislature because they set up the laws, which sets up the system. Thank you.
Very well. Thank you, counsel. And we'll put another 7.5 minutes for additional respondent counsel. So if you identify yourself for the record, you may proceed.
May it please the court, Jack Perry from the Taft Law Firm here on behalf of the intervener charter schools, the inner city charter schools. And I want to start with Judge Johnson, your questions about the education clause, and you're hitting upon what this court ruled in 2019, 6 months after the Cruz Guzman. The court said, deriving guidance from Cruz Guzman and Skeen, and based upon Cruz Guzman and Skeen, quote, they said that you're supposed to look at and require plaintiffs to prove that the legislature has failed or is failing to provide an adequate education. And then, because in Forestland, as well as here, there are different variables. In fact, the Supreme Court identifies 5 different variables that are in the complaint in this case. The court goes on the next sentence and says, when an education clause is based on one or more of these variables, a plaintiff needs to prove facts to establish those variables are actually resulting in inadequate education. Well, that is absolutely critically important, because then later on, the very next paragraph, the court talks about, Judge Johnson, you mentioned the tenure case, the Forestland case, and they said, well, in that case, they're trying to find an exception to that proof, and the court said, we're not going to provide an exception. Causation is what you need to prove. And this is the requirement, and based upon the Derek Chauvin case from 2021, it's binding on this court. They looked at Cruz Guzman, looked at the very facts we have here, the same allegations, and said, this is what you need to prove. And they went further. In the Cruz Guzman case, and the one thing the dissent and the majority agreed upon was, this is going to be a lot of work. And as a former district court judge, you understand what this would be. It was, but I think the dissent called it a Herculean task. And they talked about the volume, and that was one of the reasons the dissent dissented, was because this is too much. This goes beyond the purview of what any reasonable district court judge could possibly do. So the expectation was, we're going to look at the adequacy of the education. And that's why we are involved here as the interveners, is that the theory is that if you have racially isolated, imbalanced, segregated, however you want to call it, schools, they'll fail. Well, these charter schools have proven objectively through the MDA's own analysis of their testing scores that if you measure adequacy of education based upon reading, math, et cetera, the matrix that the state has adopted, these 3 schools, they succeed. They are adequate. And yet, under plaintiff's theory, they are unconstitutional as a matter of law. You guys don't even have to look at causation and whether they result in inadequate education, because by law, because they are, to use his phrase in the complaint, hyper-segregated, both racially and socioeconomically, they are unconstitutional. And that's where the disconnect we have in this case is that, and the Supreme Court also said in Cruz Guzman, we're not asking the district court judge, in this case Judge Robiner, we're not asking her to determine education policy. And they said that repeatedly. And in this case, as framed up in this case, without experts, without a trial, without everything, anything, all it is just, these are the numbers, same as in the complaint. That's all you need to prove. If that's the case, the district court judge is in the exact position that the Supreme Court said, we're not going to put you in, because that's not fair. The legislature is to determine, and it's based on Judge Johnson, that's what the first half of Cruz Guzman is about. It's the legislature's duty. That's in the education clause. That's what's in their decision. We're not going to ask the judiciary to determine what education policies prevail. In this case, we have a real disconnect, and it doesn't matter which community you ask, there is a disconnect. Does parent choice, is that the key to improving these scores? Or is it the integration, say it's integration policies? Both of them have strong believers in different segments in this courtroom. And the courts, you're going to look at education adequacy and what, if, whether, as interpreted by this court, do those variables translate into inadequate education? Yes or no? You are not to, Judge Robiner, determine which policy is preferable. I don't know. She doesn't know. And the court said she's not supposed to decide that. It is supposed to decide is those variables, in this case, the one that's highlighted is the racial isolation and socioeconomic isolation, is that translating into inadequate education scores? Well, if there's ever a case for expert testimony, that's it. And yet this motion was brought 6 months before the close of discovery and another 6 weeks before the close of expert discovery. So how in the world can any court be asked to make the decision? It can't be. Worse than that, Judge Slater, you began this by asking about the definition of segregation. The definition of segregation in their class is different than what plaintiff's counsel or appellant's counsel said to you. And that's why I repeated it in here, because it's different than what he told Judge Robiner early on in the case, what the definition is. Because it is simply about 20, if you have less than 20% or over 60% minority diverse, I forget how he phrased it, and socioeconomics in a school. Not compared to the school district, not compared to the community, not compared to anything, just within that school. Which means, you know, every school would apply. Every school could be segregated in the state. The definition is wrong. The timing of this case is wrong. And the premise of this case, we believe.
What definition would you provide us?
Well, I don't think under Forsland 2, because they had footnote 6, and they didn't say you had, no, they didn't tell the district court, and they were using Cruz Guzman as an example of what you do. That panel did not say that you have to determine what segregation means. You just have to look at that variable. And so I don't think that we have to get to that issue. We have to get what Judge Johnson's talking about is, whatever's happening in a classroom, whether they take Higher Ground Academy, whatever things you're doing, are you providing adequate education? And our premise is that the way you solve this is, if I can finish, I'm sorry. Okay, I'm sorry. The way you address the most effectively, solve is the wrong word, I apologize, is you have accountability with teeth to accountability. And the reason that the charter schools are here, we are the perfect example, because we are late after the fact, only created 30 years ago, there is accountability. We have 1, 3, 5 year reviews, and we can be shut down because each school is reviewed separately, unlike all the public schools. So charter schools aren't perfect, but they have the structure in place, back to Judge Johnson's point, that the legislature has put in place to make sure charter schools do provide an adequate education with remedies to the parents and the students to complain to the authorizer and to the MDE to take enforcement action. That's the longer answer. I apologize. Thank you.
Even though your time has expired, may I inquire if just one? I'm trying to reconcile your proposition that the Supreme Court was, using your terms in your brief, demonstrably false in the premise in footnote 6 with our intermediate court authority and interpreting footnote 6.
I think that, did I say that? I'm not sure what is this something in my brief or what?
I'm looking at the intervener brief.
Yeah.
In reference to footnote 6. This was, as well, demonstrably false. And it seems like you're challenging, I'm not sure whether you're challenging footnote 6 itself or just the interpretation of footnote 6.
Just the interpretation. No, I mean, the footnote 6 is, I mean, Judge Justice Hudson wrote what she wrote. And only thing we are saying about footnote 6 is that is the law. No question is a segregated public school system violates the education clause. absolutely 100% behind that. The question is did the Supreme Court do what Judge Slater is asking about? Did they make a finding that Minneapolis-St. Paul actually is a segregated system of public schools? And I say, no, that didn't happen. And under Rule 12, it couldn't happen. So if I wrote that inarticulately, I apologize,
no,
Judge Ross.
Maybe just my, I'm sure you were.
Well, no, I'm sure not. Thank you.
Very well. Counsel for appellant, may I have 5 minutes?
Thank you. May it please the court. In terms of in our motion, we said that we would accept the state's definition of what constitutes undue racial concentration in a school. And the state, from 1978 to 1999, had a 15% variance from the overall district demographics. In 1999 to today, the variance has to be 20% or more. We said that's not our definition. That's the state's. That's what we'll accept. Now, there is a fundamental difference that I think opposing counsel have overlooked between the Equal Protection Clause of the Federal Constitution and the Education Clause of the Minnesota Constitution. The Education Clause, the Due Process, the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment requires action by the state to deprive somebody of a right. The Education Clause of the Minnesota Constitution is not a prohibition, as is the 14th Amendment. It is a mandate for the state to do something. And if the state doesn't do it, that's a violation. State agrees with us. They say they have a duty and they have to perform it. And their intent in whether they don't perform is irrelevant. Now, the court here, in talking about causation, said, analogized it to tort. The education clause, she says, this is a constitutional claim, therefore it's a tort claim. That is a false analogy. The better analogy is a contract claim, where under a contract, the promisor has an obligation to do something. And if the promisor doesn't do it, unless the contract provides some excuse or out, that's a breach. That is what exists here. Now, and
Mr. Schulman, using that analogy, though, then the plaintiff in a breach of contract still has to prove that the promise has been violated. And,
right.
And so by seeking early dismissal, there's been no evidence yet of that. That seems inconsistent.
There has, in fact, been evidence. There are four facts that are undisputed on this record. One is the demographics and the degree of racial imbalance, separation, or isolation in numerous schools in Minneapolis and St. Paul. That's undisputed. The second undisputed fact is that has not changed over a prolonged period of years. In fact, in certain circumstances, it's become worse. The third undisputed fact is that there is an achievement gap between African Americans, Hispanics, and Native Americans, and white students, a substantial achievement gap. And the fourth fact is that gap has not changed over a period of time. So these kids are not learning. They are not getting an adequate education. And an adequate education has been defined in Supreme Court jurisprudence in Minnesota. And that is, it's in Skeen, and it's in our case, and in particular, it is a reference to Pauley v. Kelly, which is a West Virginia case that the court has cited and quoted with approval, which lists the elements. I think there are nine or 10, maybe 11, of things that an education has to do, like literacy, numeracy, awareness of politics, ability to live on one's own. Those are all in there. So we are not asking this court to do, and the district court, and the Supreme Court made note of that, and it hasn't changed. We are not asking the district court to do anything more than find that that the state has violated the Constitution. The reason we concentrate on the legislature is because the burden is put on the legislature by the Constitution. Now, as I think Judge Johnson noted, yes, the administrative bodies are supposed to enforce and apply and implement the directives of the legislature. But if there's a violation, the buck stops with the legislature. So we are asking that the court find that there has been a violation, that the court enjoin the continuation of the violation, and that the court direct the legislature to come up with a remedy for the violation. We are not saying what that remedy should be, but for the court to say that it has to involve moving citizens based on race is not true.
We can answer the certified question without going forward with the particular dispositions that you've
recommended. That's right. But until that question is answered, we're in limbo, and the court's in limbo. And so,
Judge Slater, may I?
Yes.
That's good. Mr. Shulman, under your theory and given your interpretation of footnote 6, are the charter schools represented by Mr. Perry per se violations of law under the Education Clause?
Not necessarily. Now, one thing about charter schools, the evidence in this case, and I'm going to refer the court to, this is in the record, this is the affidavit or declaration of Will Stancil, which has been submitted in terms of research on charter schools. And what Mr. Stancil found has determined most recently, and this was because of the age of this case, 2017, is that charter schools do not perform as well, overall do not perform as well as traditional public schools. There is a significant gap between their scores in reading and mathematics. And that is in the record, Exhibit 364, docket number 364, Exhibit A.
Let me ask a follow-up question. Under your theory and your interpretation of footnote 6, are those charter schools segregated in the manner described in footnote 6?
Yes.
Very well.
Thank you.
Thank you to counsel. A very important issue, obviously. We will take the matter under advisement, and thank you for your briefing and answers to our questions, and have a good day, everyone.